Hey everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
This episode is brought to you by Ancestry. You can savor your story in a whole new way with Ancestry DNA. With over 350 regions and 2 times the geographic detail of other DNA tests, Ancestry can connect you to the culture, cuisines, and traditions of your heritage in a deeper way. Learn more at ancestry.com/MTBE. That's MTBE as in meant to be eaten.
This week, it's the season finale of Meat and Three. We're following up our episode about youth with a look at age and how aging affects life on farms and in kitchens.
At the most basic level, we need people to grow food for a growing global population.
The question of planning for retirement or old age as a cook, it's almost one that doesn't exist bizarrely until it's too late.
We also have a story about a food that might be older than you think.
A recent archaeological finding might have CrossFitters everywhere reevaluating their diets.
Plus, a story about one of Atlanta's most historic and risque landmarks.
There are dancers that have been there 20 and 30 years.
Don't miss our season finale of Meat and Three, available wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to Meant to Be Eaten on Heritage Radio Network. I'm your host, Coral Lee. Quote unquote, Twitter roaster and author of Real Inequality, a book that examines the barriers African American, Asian American, and Latina/Latino actors face in Hollywood and how they creatively challenge stereotypes. Sociologist Nancy Yuen studies the ways in which Asian Americans are represented or not in media. Thanks so much for joining me today.
Thanks for having me, Cole.
So we should mention Nancy's joining us via Skype from Mexico right now, where she's on vacation. But where are you originally from?
That's a good question for Asian Americans. Always kind of tricky. Mm-hmm. I was born in Taiwan, Taipei, Taiwan, and I immigrated to Southern California when I was 5. So grew up in California mostly, and so I consider myself 1.5 generation Chinese American.
We're in Southern California.
So I first immigrated to Long Beach and then pretty much grew up in kind of the Cerritos area. Now I'm in the suburbs, but I also spent a large portion of my life in Los Angeles because I went to UCLA both for undergrad and grad school.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so when people think of LA, they're always like, oh yeah, there's like a ton of different immigration populations, but on top of that, so I grew up in Southern California too, like there's all these sub neighborhoods of like different types of Chinese people. So how did you see Asian American culture change in its perception growing up?
Oh, wow. I think I grew up thinking that only like certain generations were speaking maybe Mandarin or Cantonese or whatever. But I think even recently when I was in the kind of San Gabriel area, like there's constant waves of immigrants. And so there's young people who are maybe bilingual who are 1.5, but there are also young immigrants who are first gen, who just arrived. So I realized it's hard for me to tell by looking at someone whether, you know, what generation they are based on their ages. And yes, there's like little Taiwan, I think, in kind of the Roland Heights, Hacienda Heights area. But overall, when I grew up in Long Beach, there were Southeast Asian refugee kids. And then when I grew up in kind of the Cerritos area, there's Japanese Americans, Korean Americans, Filipinos, South Asians. It's definitely a pan-Asian American experience growing up in Southern California.
Yeah, I grew up in Newport, which is next to Irvine. And there's kind of like, oh, you got to go to Garden Grove for Thai food, or you got to get like boba and Irvine. And there's all these like different sub neighborhoods.
It's a heaven for Asian
yeah,
food.
Yeah, really.
For sure. Like Little India actually was in Artesia, like one of the biggest, Indian populations. And I just grew up kind of taking for granted that I had such great access to food. Like, I didn't even bother learning the names because I would just go to some restaurant and just kind of eat the buffet. Mm-hmm. So, mm-hmm, totally. But it was so authentic. It was delicious.
Yeah. And so now you're teaching at Biola, right?
Correct. So that's another, I don't know, immigrant mm-hmm. Populated. I think traditionally white, but now there are a lot of Korean Americans who've moved in there. It's a suburb. It's a suburb of Los Angeles County.
Mm-hmm. And so as you're teaching this now growing immigrant student population, do you see the same, this is kind of a loaded question, but do you see the same kind of racism / microaggressions that you experienced as a student?
Unfortunately, yes. I think mm-hmm. those things, even though Southern California is so diverse because it's a car culture, it's we don't have a lot of public spaces where people interact on a daily basis. So I think that there's still a lot of ignorance about people groups that look different from you. So I think microaggressions, I mean, in LA, there's still kind of this kind of go back to your country rhetoric that happens. And I know that, yeah, that my Asian American students are still experience the kind of forever foreigner, where are you from? Where are you really from? Kind of questions mm-hmm. that even though all they are feeling is that, hey, we're Americans too.
Right. And if anything, it's like these smaller minority populations are kind of taking over these neighborhoods and kind of defining the food culture and defining the just any culture of this neighborhood. And it's still funny to see that they're still seen as outsiders.
Yeah, I think that when I did a documentary, actually, a while back, I interviewed a young white man who said that he was disturbed by the fact that there were so many businesses with just Chinese signs, right? Which a lot of these restaurants, they just have the Chinese signage because their food is so kind of authentically just for the community that there's still this kind of, there's this xenophobia that develops because of this kind of segregation, right, between food and authentic for the community kind of businesses. So that's definitely an issue. And food, you know, food is very close to a person's heart. So I think that a lot of times feeling kind of isolated from food restaurants can create this this greater sense of xenophobia.
Yeah, there's this NYU student who's doing this thesis, or at least it's like a little Instagram page that's called Your Yelp Review is Racist. And one of the reviews says something like, oh, you know, the restaurant was wonderfully ethnic. And it makes me think of this, where it's like, if there is signage that is only in Chinese, shouldn't that be kind of like an exciting sign? Like, oh, this is a really authentically Sichuan restaurant or Cantonese restaurant. And why isn't that enticing to someone, you know?
I think that there's a lot of, so there's not just the signage, but the food itself, I think, is pretty scary to people. Mm. I read the recent Crazy Rich Asians article that was in the Hollywood Reporter mentioned how the actors oftentimes are the only Asian actors on their sets. So, but then on this set, when they could go to the kind of night market and eat whatever, they didn't have to explain or worry about whether their co-cast members are going to be offended by the food or it's too spicy for them. They could just kind of be themselves and just enjoy the food and not have to worry about what somebody else thinks about the food that they're eating.
That's so bizarre. So I'm just going to kind of backtrack a little bit. I don't know if you've heard the podcast Still Processing. It's from NPR, but they did a 2-part episode on racism against Asian Americans and just kind of honestly just raising awareness and just saying like, look, this actually happens. And I'm going to have you explain some of these terms that they use, which one of them being model minority and code switching. And also you talked about not being able to distinguish whether someone is one first generation, 1.5 or second, and what that all means, because some people it's even enough to be like, I didn't even know there's different types of Chinese people.
Yeah. So, okay, let's start with model minority. So this is the idea. So it's kind of complicated. I'm going to try to simplify it. The idea that Asian Americans they worked hard enough. So even if they came from, you know, nothing, that they come to this country and they're able to overcome poverty, able to kind of achieve middle class or upper middle class status through hard work, right? So kind of meritocratic idea, and somehow they're culturally more attuned to be able to do this. So that's another part. So all this is the myth of the model minority, right? Because immigration allows only certain kinds of people to come over in terms of from Asia. And so a lot of the 1965 immigrants, they were all highly educated, and that's still the kind of continuous wave, although there are different classes, but the majority of the kind of model minority, the people that fall into that are East Asian, South Asian, and these are the kind of elites of those groups that come over here. So rather than thinking that there's something innate or inborn about Asians working hard and being able to, you know, be quote unquote smart and successful, that this is a result of kind of immigration laws, right? And so, and of course, there's been research that shows that Asians actually have the biggest wealth disparities of all racial groups. So there are people groups like Hmong and other Southeast Asian groups that end up on welfare because they are coming with less resources. And so there's a big disparity actually within the Asian American moniker, which really encompasses a huge group of people that don't even share the same languages or culture. So it's it's really hard to kind of accept the mono minority as truth, but then it's such a huge kind of myth that people really believe that Asians are good at math, Asians are somehow hardworking. But of course, the downside of that is that Asians are competitive, they're taking over. So even the mono minority isn't all positive. And also research or just kind of how it came about was also to kind of be used as a wedge between whites and other minorities to look at, oh, well, if they can do it, if Asians can work hard, why do we need welfare? Why do we need, you know, affirmative action? Why do we need any of that? Because all you have to do is just work hard enough and you can achieve that. And so it's a very complex myth, right? So I think this is something that I always have to teach my students as well, because people grow up with this myth as truth and they believe it. Even Asian Americans adopt it themselves. But in fact, that it's a dangerous myth on so many levels. So that's my minority. Mm-hmm. So code switching. Code switching is interesting because there's code switching in terms of between languages, like an Asian language and English. But the latest films, like Sorry to Bother You, and even the upcoming film Black Klansman, there's code switching even amongst like African Americans going from quote unquote white sounding English to more kind of community, black community English, right? So there's code switching in that sense too. But so that's something we could talk about a little bit further if you have questions about that.
Yeah, wait, so code refers to language?
Yes, so languages, but not necessarily different languages. It could be even within the same language, but different forms of that language, right? So, yeah. And then there is generations. So I said that I was 1.5 generations. So I came to the United States as a young immigrant at age 5. So between the ages of 5 and 12, you're approximately, you can call yourself 1.5 generation. First generation is an immigrant generation that comes at adulthood coming to this country. They're first generation Americans, so Asian Americans, Latinx, and then their second generation are the U.S. born children of the first generation immigrants, and then their children become third generation and so on and so forth.
Got it. Okay. So back to, you mentioned your students. What do you teach at Biola?
So I teach an Asian American studies course. I also teach a course on, you know, film and TV and racism and sexism. And then I teach also a research class. So
that's super cool. I did a lot of internet stalking. You've written a ton of books, one of them being an encyclopedia on Asian American actors. And so, which I think is just so incredible to have assembled an encyclopedia. And how can you talk about the process of that and also how you kind of intend for it to be used?
So I just wrote the entry for Asian American actors, but the entire encyclopedia is actually on Asian Americans. So yeah, so I was part of the assemblage of that. So to just kind of have a definitive form, you know, a definitive mm-hmm. volume on what it means to be Asian Americans. And I did research on Asian American actors to kind of highlight the people who've come before this generation, all the way back to, you know, like someone like Anna May Wong, and Sesue Hayakawa, who are in the silent era to all the way to today. And so, yeah, so that was, it was really fun to kind of put that together.
Mm-hmm. So it was on Asian American culture in general, the encyclopedia. That's crazy. Sure. So, and then your two other books that you wrote or co-wrote, are, one is called Without a Trace and the other one is Performing Race, negotiating identity, which I thought were super provocative titles. And do you feel like these things are unique to the Asian American experience, or is it just kind of to any immigrant?
I think that there are overlaps with other immigrant populations for sure, but there are also specificity with the Asian American, and again within the Asian American community, mm-hmm. there is also specificity with, you know, kind of disaggregating the different immigrant groups and the different ethnic groups even within that. So it's very complicated, right? So when we try to generalize, there are things that I think are generalizable in order to kind of understand on a larger scale, but then we also have to take into account that there are differences. And with the Asian American population, I think the idea of Asian American is a political identity, because immigrants come, they're like we're Japanese, we're Chinese, and in fact that there's distrust even between those groups from kind of the homeland. Mm-hmm. But then to come over here and all of a sudden become Asian American, it is a kind of a generational evolution. I feel like as 1.5, as second generation and beyond, people are more likely to identify as Asian American. But I don't think the first generation necessarily takes on that identity.
And you did this, I think it's like a 10-year study tracking Asian Americans and Pacific Islanders in media. And I was thinking, and like, I can't even think of maybe more than 5 movies that have an Asian American lead or a character at all. And can you talk about what you found there? Like, it says they don't. Or, yeah, how they compare to Western series in terms of numbers, screen time, how stereotypes are depicted, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, so we were looking specifically at television, which is doing a lot better, I think, than mm-hmm. what you were saying in terms of film, because we don't, yeah, I can barely think of any leads. And in fact, a lot of those leads are played by white actors, right?
So that's, right. Oh, my gosh. Wasn't that like the Matt Damon movie recently? The like Great Wall? Yeah. Oh, my goodness. That was the worst.
Yeah, that was a white savior. I guess there's the white savior, and then there's the whitewashing, right? Where they write in basically a white, usually male savior of the entire kind of country of whatever mm-hmm. Asian country they choose. And in the Matt Damon example, that was China, where he kind of is the savior of China in the medieval time. So it's interesting because there's arguments of, well, you know, Game of Thrones is set in medieval Europe. There aren't any Asians or people of color there, but then you can put like Matt Damon in a medieval China, because somehow, you know, he can make his way over to China, no problem. So there's definitely a kind of, you know, it can't even compare, because it really is about, I guess, who gets to tell the story, right? Although in mm-hmm. that case, it's actually Zhang Yimou, who is a Chinese director. But I guess it's this idea of what does Hollywood, what do American audiences want to see? And there's this misunderstanding, I think, that is perpetuated by the continual exclusion of people of color, that Americans want to only see white male leads, or maybe sometimes white female leads. Mm-hmm. But yeah, so that's I think that's the problem, right, in terms of representation. So what we found in television is that 10 years ago, it was really, really bad. We were way underrepresented. Now the numbers are better, but then we're excluded from majority of shows, right? So if the numbers are better, it's like we're all on one show, like Fresh Off the Boat, right?
Oh, yeah, I was just about to say Fresh Off the Boat.
Right, if Fresh Off the Boat gets canceled, I think we found that almost all of the majority of the Asian Americans were concentrated on like I think a handful of shows, like maybe 10, 15 shows, right? So if you were to cancel those shows, we'd disappear from television altogether. So, and then we found that it's like shows set in cities that are highly populated with Asian Americans, like Los Angeles, New York, that majority of those shows actually didn't have Asian American regulars on those shows. So there's still this kind of segregation, and we're missing. So if you're not watching, you know, Fresh Off the Boat, you may not be seeing an Asian American, but Fresh Off the Boat didn't exist 10 years ago. I mean, there was All American Girl that existed at one point in time, but that was 20 years, right, prior to Fresh Off the Boat. And that's it's just kind of like the Joy Luck Club to Crazy Rich Asians. It's like we have this blip in history, mm-hmm. and then we disappear for decades, and then we reappear. So we're hoping, the community is hoping, that with Crazy Rich Asians and these upcoming movies and television shows, that it won't be a blip anymore, but that it'll be a continuous representational stream.
So why do TV shows and movies differ in terms of diversity?
I think that there's more platforms for television, right? So now we have streaming, We have Netflix, we have Amazon, we even have Hulu now. And those streaming platforms have a different business model than broadcast television, right? So before, 10 years ago, really broadcast television, some cable was coming in, but their goal, because of advertising, is to reach the largest segment of audiences, mm-hmm. right? In their mind, that has always been the white audience. But with streaming, they're looking for niche audiences who may not be finding what they want to see on kind of mainstream broadcast television, but they're looking for special shows. So they might subscribe to something like Netflix in order to see something like Master of None, you know, or Orange is the New Black. So shows that are not as represented on mainstream television. So I think with the advent of streaming platforms, there is an opening of additional shows that can reach audiences that haven't been reached before, and that means Asian Americans as well as other audiences of color can be seeing themselves more in these shows. So I think that the competition and just kind of a proliferation of content, I mean, there's so many more shows on now than there were 10 years ago. So I think that's made a difference.
And so you also studied relationships and stereotypes in these TV shows. And I was wondering if TV shows are doing an okay job of doing that, or is it still a matter, like, they're still perpetuating stereotypes and Asians only date other Asians? What do you think?
Yeah, we haven't investigated that fully. It's actually, even 10 years ago, there were some interracial, like, I think Sandra Oh was dating a black doctor on Grey's Anatomy. So, and then there are interracial relationships, but I think that actually there's fewer, and Lost was 10 years ago as well, which had the first kind of Korean-American Korean couple that was on TV. So I think that there is more interracial relationships as well as family sitcoms with Fresh Off the Boat. And during our follow-up study, also Dr. Ken came on, and Dr. Ken is actually really significant, even though it was only on for a couple seasons. It actually showed a second generation and third generation family, right? Because Ken and Ken Jeong and Susie Nakamura played second generation native born or U.S. born Asian Americans, and then their children were third generation, which is actually brand new. I mean, there were so many firsts of that show, but I think that people just didn't really pay attention to Dr. Ken very much. But it actually had, and they were inter-ethnic. So he was Korean American, and she played Japanese American, which the actors are. And they actually talked about that on the show. So, and actually in terms of food, they actually talked about like having different kinds of foods and Thanksgiving. So it was really interesting to be able to have that. And that's definitely an improvement from 10 years ago, and certainly from All American Girl, when they had Uncle Ben's rice on set. And I think it really, because, you know, whoever was creating was building the set didn't have, like, they didn't have any knowledge of Asian food. So they mm-hmm. brought on, you know, parboiled rice. And so I remember the actors, someone told me where they were like, really kind of like, it just made the whole set seem like not authentic, even for the actors who are sitting there pretending to eat, you know, Uncle Ben's rice. So, mm-hmm.
Yeah. So you're talking about, this Dr. Ken show. And so they had second and third generation. And so it's not just that these people are playing their characters, but they're also playing their kind of cultural struggle. And so what is the way to represent that on TV? Like, what are these unique struggles that Western audiences might not be super familiar with?
Yeah, so the episode where they talked about their ethnicity was passing that on to their children, but then they themselves may not have they've assimilated as second generation, right? Mm-hmm. So the hilarity of that episode was that Ken Jeong came on in a hanbok, which is a Korean female dress, mm-hmm. so because to represent that he really didn't really know what authentic Korean culture was, so that was part of the joke. But I think that kind of that gimmick really was not just a gimmick, but it was showing that, yes, you know, second generation, we have this kind of guilt of, wow, how do we raise our children when we maybe don't even speak the language anymore, and the kind of traditions and cultures we kind of understand, but only superficially. So I think that kind of struggle really was actually shown in the show, which I feel like in in Fresh Off the Boat, they also had a segment of that in terms of, you know, what Chinese New Year, you know, how do we pass on Chinese New Year? Because in Asian American culture in the United States, the kind of attrition rate of language is very high from first to second generation. By third generation, I think 90-some% cannot speak their mother tongues anymore. Mm-hmm. So this kind of attrition, I think, it's unique between second and third generation, because that attrition is just kind of like weird. It's like, how do we pass on? How do I speak, you know, Mandarin to my kids when I can't even like survive in Asia myself? You
totally,
know?
Totally, yeah. I'm speaking with sociologist and author Nancy Yuan. Meant to be Eaten. We'll be right back after a short break. This episode is brought to you by Ancestry. You can savor your story in a whole new way with Ancestry DNA, and I'm excited to experience this firsthand. Thanks to Ancestry, I'm going to have the opportunity to find out more about my own heritage. I recently got an Ancestry DNA kit in the mail and immediately wanted to get the process started. However, the kit said saliva samples are best in the early morning before you eat or drink anything, so I waited until the next morning. Before even putting my contacts in, I opened the vial, switched my morning breath saliva in, and it felt super futuristic to pop down the blue liquid into my saliva sample and then shake it all around. I dropped it off at a bodega UPS point in the middle of a run. It was super convenient. To be quite honest, I don't know that I'll discover anything that surprising. My mom's family immigrated to Brooklyn from southern China, and my dad's from Hong Kong via England. However, I've heard that a lot of people find out that they have origins in a part of the world that they never expected. Ancestry DNA includes over 350 regions and 2 times the geographic detail of other DNA tests, so we'll see. By next week, I'll have my test results in hand, and I'll share what I found out about my ancestry. Tune in to find out if I'm 100% Chinese like I think I am, or if I discover something surprising in my family's history. We'll see how Ancestry DNA helps me connect to the culture, cuisines, and traditions of my heritage in a deeper way. In the meantime, go to ancestry.com/MTBE. That's MTBE as in meant to be eaten, to learn how Ancestry can help you savor your own story. And so we were just talking about this inability to pass on our own culture as second or third generation Asian Americans. And this actually made me think of, you know, the idea of the banana, like, right? Like, we're yellow on the outside but white on the inside. And I remember growing up on the playground, and it was like I was never white enough. You know, I just like wanted to blend in. I just wanted to eat a bologna sandwich, and I just wanted to, you know, not have a stinky lunch. But then when I go home growing up now, it's like, am I Asian enough? You know, like, this is really sad. I won't be able to take my kids to dim sum, or like when I take my friends to Chinese restaurants, it's like I still order in English. And so I was wondering how you are 1.5. So how do you kind of navigate these kind of cultural tensions?
Yeah, so as 1.5, my accent is right on, okay. But then my vocabulary is completely like, I'm actually best with food and menus, because mm-hmm. I think that's like more practiced over time. But anything like political or anything that's kind of takes schooling, actual schooling or living in that country, I'm completely kind of out of my element. But I do worry, I think about, like, I am kind of the cultural translator. Every time we go to Chinese restaurants or whatever, or anything that requires more speaking, I'm the translator for my entire family. I'm married to someone who's second generation, and so he has very little Chinese. And then my kids are, you know, I sometimes force them to just order in Mandarin just to, because I worry. I think, like, oh my gosh, are they going to be able to get Taiwanese breakfast? Mm-hmm. You know, because there's no one there really speaks English, because mm-hmm. we're in the very, very authentic restaurants where really it's for the community. The people that work there aren't fluent in English. And so I think, like, I worry. I think, like, are they going to be able to access this food after I die? Like, I think about things like, so.
What was that dish called? We don't know what it is.
Yes, because they just always relied on me, right? Mm-hmm. Like, and they'll say it in English, or we'll make some weird translation in English that's
it's
not
like
a real translation.
Shrimp in rice, and it's like that's like 50 different things. Thanks for nothing. Yeah.
The other day we played a alphabet game, and we're like Chinese food, right? We're gonna do Chinese food, and when it came to H, like my husband who's Cantonese, he said ha gao, and which is it's not an H word, but that's how you say it in Cantonese, and I guess the phoneticization would be H. Mm-hmm. And my kids have no idea what that was. Right? And then I said it in Mandarin, and they still didn't know what that was, right? And then we're like, you know, and then I tried to translate. I was like, you know, that shrimp in the kind of translucent skin that we eat in dim sum. Because I don't know what the English is, right? Mm-hmm. So it's like, I guess it's like shrimp dumpling, but that doesn't really capture it, right? Because there's so many shrimp dumplings out there.
Totally. Yeah. Yeah, I was, I talked about this on the show before, but I was really craving like the Cantonese soup when I was sick, like those like different herbs and things. And so I went to this herb store in Chinatown, and I know you have to use bitter almond and sweet almond, but then they're all just called almond on the package, and they're like 40 different brands that all just say almond. So it was just kind of like, great, you know, like what if this is, at least I could kind of tell the difference, but what if it's something else that I will, you know, maybe never be able to eat again because I have no clue what I'm buying.
It's so hard. Like I think about, you know, I'm interested in Korean and Japanese food, and I'll go to those markets and I'll try to guess based on what I've eaten at restaurants, you know, mm-hmm. and it's really, really hard. And the dried form of things, right? It's if I want a translucent noodle, but I'm not sure what the dried form looks like. Mm-hmm. And it's just, but then it's like what you said, it's like, I'm interested, right? And I want to know more. And yes, there's loss in translation, but I wish I had that knowledge rather than kind of a fear, like, oh, if I don't know that, then it must be bad or it must be gross, right? So I think that I think the benefit of growing up Asian American and in, you know, in kind of contact with different Asian cultures where the food, there's overlap and there's just, you know, interest. And because I grew up pretty much in my Korean friends' households, I would go to their houses to eat. I kind of grew up with all these little dishes, and sometimes I'll try to make my own. I think it's just this, it's really a great cross-cultural experience that I really appreciate being Asian American.
Mm-hmm. So let's go back to TV. We were talking about the strides that Asian Americans and Pacific Islanders, maybe strides is a bit of a stretch, but how about Asian food? How is it represented in media?
I have this great, just seeing this on screen, for Fresh Off the Boat, there was this one scene where Randall Park's character, Lewis, is washing a huge stalk of bok choy in the sink. And I saw that and I thought, oh my gosh, I've never seen that before on TV. Mm-hmm. And I thought, that is exactly how we do it, you know, because these vegetables are so big. You can't use a colander. I mean, I try because I'm just lazy. But the best way to do it is to do it in the sink. And I think that that was so like such a huge kind of leap from the Uncle Ben's rice on All American Girl. And I thought, wow, you know, Asia America has finally arrived to be able to have that kind of representation of food. And I think that food is so important in terms of authenticity, because food is, I think, across different classes. Like everybody that I knew of that are Chinese American cares about food like it's the most important thing in the house, right? Mm-hmm. Like the idea that like food is medicinal, like if you're, you know, sick, you have to eat this kind of food, but you can't eat that kind of food because this one has heat and this one has, you know, this one is cooling. Mm-hmm. So all that knowledge, I mean, I don't have that knowledge. This is another like growing up in the United States, but I felt like everybody in Asia just instinctively knows. I don't know. I don't think they teach that stuff in school, but they just know from, I think, growing up and being told things over time by their families, right? And so I think that having that representation of just even having vegetables in a sink is tremendous. But I would love to have, yeah, that this idea of like, yeah, after, you know, after you give birth, you have to have this 1 month of, you know, eating particular foods and not all these kind of things that are traditional, but also have health and medicinal. And I think that it's funny because I think Western culture will just, you know, call it homeopathic, or they'll have all sorts of other fancy names for it, you know, whereas I think in Asia it's just part of the culture. And I think that I haven't seen so much of that being represented, but something like bao, I think, is kind of the first food-based kind of Disney film that's like really captures kind of how food and family are completely interwoven in ways that I think maybe Western audiences don't fully understand, because they're just like heating up some TV dinner or something or getting fast food. Whereas I think cooking and family. And like, I remember growing up wrapping dumplings with my grandma. That's just kind of have something that all kids do with their families. If they cook things from scratch, which, you know, people in Asia do. And so I think that that's something that, so seeing something like bao is pretty tremendous.
Yeah. I want to talk about bao, but first, when I asked the question about food in media, I didn't even think about Fresh Off the Boat. The first thing I thought about was Bizarre Foods, or like Phil Eats Everything, I think it's called, or like all those kind of travel shows, and how even Ugly Delicious, and how the protagonist goes to this country and they eat this slimy thing, and it's like a matter of, you know, I conquered this. I ate this. It was kind of gross, but I ate it. And so why is that problematic, and why are we still watching TV like that?
Oh yeah, it's definitely a form of cultural appropriation, and I think that it's unfortunate that that Asia is always seen as this like land of strangeness and exotica, and food is part of that, right? And I think that so it's like, it's almost like those are like hunting videos of, mm-hmm. of people going and like, I got this, you know, this tiger, this exotic tiger. Oh, I ate this, you know, exotic weird food. And I think that, and it's always like from a form of like someone who is in, you know, in positions of power and being able to kind of go and sit amongst like these, you know, Asians that are portrayed as strange and other, whereas it's like that food is interesting and you conquer it. But then when it's here in the United States, it's seen as problematic or like, ew, you know, gross. So it's this really interesting thing where it's like, because it's so othered when it's in the United States, it doesn't seem to belong because of these shows, right? When these shows, it's like it's only in these weird places. And then when it's here, it doesn't seem like, even when it's here, it's still othered. Whereas, you know, we can think of it as this is American food too, right? Mm-hmm. Because immigrants come and they bring food. And that's part of what American culture is evolving. I mean, what is American food? Like tacos are now, like, I feel like are as much of American food that, as it is in Mexico. And so I think, I just ate Taco Bell on the way driving down to Mexico. And I was like, hey, I just joke like, oh, well, this is like, you know, our first like entree into like Mexican food. I mean, I knew it wasn't. It's totally Mexican American. I don't even know if it's Mexican American. It's just American, right?
It's just Taco Bell.
Right,
it's its own cuisine, yeah.
But it's so much a part of, it's a part of Americana, and so I think that for us to, and you know, those articles about how Asian and Mexican food, like they're so inexpensive. So it's like I've seen so many of those shows where they go to like Asia, and it's like they go to like not fancy restaurants, but like poor people, right? Or it's like they're making it right on a boat or something, right? Like those kind of shows where, and it just shows like, I think it diminishes at the same time. It doesn't honor the fact that it is everyday people's foods. Mm-hmm. I can't explain. Does that make sense? It's like,
no,
it's
totally.
Everyday people's foods, but then it's seen as this exotic and like poor or something. And I think that they don't understand that food actually, I think, goes across different classes in Asia, that it's just such a important part of our lives. That we don't see it as exotic, you know, and I think that it's unfortunate that these food shows haven't really done justice to, I think, what Asian food and the kind of different, so much variation in Asian food, and that Asian food should be seen on the same level as European food.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So is there a way, do you think, for these shows to sensibly portray Asian cultures' foods, or is it just a matter of like taking a step back and letting those people speak for themselves?
I think that Ugly Delicious does an interesting job of, I think, interviewing and incorporating people of, you know, chefs that are of that country. I haven't seen actually the Asian ones. I've only seen the European ones, but I think that allowing people of that country, or including people, Asian Americans, like to speak for their food themselves, rather than this kind of, you know, outsider coming in who seems to have a kind of position of power, being able to comment and say, you know, I conquer this, or ew, or whatever, versus the people that actually live and breathe that food to be able to speak for themselves. So allowing kind of ownership and self-representation, right? Own stories of people who aren't going to exoticize it, who aren't going to talk down about it or talk about it in terms of like conquering, because that is, you know, that's what they make.
Mm-hmm. And so let's go back to Bao, which is actually how I find you or found you to our listeners. I found Nancy through an Instagram of a tweet that you posted about Bao. So 21st century, and how you talked about how it actually made you cry because of how accurate the representation was. And I was so shocked by that. I was, you know, mindlessly scrolling, and I actually went to go to YouTube and found all these super janky pirated bootleg clips of Bao just to, so I could see what this amazing representation was. And you're right. Like, it's actually close enough. And I was wondering if you can give a synopsis of the short and what about it made it so powerful for you.
So it's a really, I think, insider look into what a Chinese American family, and with its specificity, I think can be extrapolated to other families as well. So it starts with, if I can remember, it's a short before The Incredibles, right? So it's a Pixar short, and the mother, there's a mother who is making bao from scratch, and then the bao comes to life, and then it shows her actually, I think, it's like it becomes like a child, and she takes care of it. She plays with it. They, you know, you see their kind of familial bond, and then the child starts to grow up and become like a teenager and have its rebellion. All this time, it's still a bow, which is the kind of interesting thing. So you understand it's kind of like, you know, not realistic. But then the bow goes up and then dates someone and leaves, wants to leave, and she takes the bow. And so this is the spoiler where she actually eats it. And when I was watching in the theater, I gasped along with other people. We're like, because it feels so cannibalistic and out of the blue. Right? It's like, what is going on? And so right after I gasped, I just laughed. It just was so funny. It was like she ate it, and then you it's like it's shocking, and then you all of a sudden you understand, right? Mm-hmm. You understand that she loves this bao so much that she does not want the bao to leave, and she is willing to eat it. And so, and then you see she's upset, she's depressed, and then you see the picture of her actual son, who looks a lot like the bao, and you realize the son has grown up, and the story is really about the son. It was a metaphor about the son moving away, but the son actually comes back with his wife, who is this blonde white woman, and then they start to make baos together. And you see that there's this kind of reconciliation at the end. And so you understand, oh, the bao was really just, you know, her kind of imagining of her entire kind of life with her son and missing him. So it was just a lovely story. And the kind of crying is just kind of the authenticity in the food and even the set. She had aluminum foil on the burners, which so many people, I think I saw through social media, could relate. You know, this kind of like, you know, growing up with people who put aluminum foil on their burners so the food, because, you know, when we're making Asian food or ethnic food, whatever, it gets all over the place and you don't want it to fall in the stove. Mm-hmm. So we put aluminum foil on that. So things like that. And just, I think just seeing something that is so authentically Asian American, that Asians can relate to, done in a Disney Pixar film, and having the relationship and seeing the kind of relationship of what does it mean to have your family grow up and leave you? Because in Asian cultures, families typically, I mean, in Asia, people actually live in multi-generational households. I grew up in Taiwan. My grandmother raised me. So I literally wasn't in a multi-generational household. Even as my parents left and immigrated to the United States, I stayed with my grandmother. So the idea of like, and she was, you know, she was devastated by her children leaving and going away. And it made me think about that, you know, how did my grandmother feel, you know, when my father left for the United States? And I think that the immigration story is in there as well. And so I think it just was so beautiful.
Mm-hmm. And you said you gasped with the crowd, but it also left a lot of audience members very confused. They were like, why is this cannibalistic? And I saw this other tweet that was like, this is confusing because white people like grow up with their families, leave at 18, and then dump your parents into a nursing home, which is like so awful. But it is like, it is very culturally specific, and it is really confusing to people that don't have that kind of empty nest syndrome thing that's unique to Chinese culture. And so why is this confusing, and how how are non-Asian people to watch this and make sense of it?
Yeah, I think that there are, you know, I don't want to generalize to all white families. I'm sure there are white families that are also very close to their children. But I think that overall, the United States, the Western culture is much more individualistic, right? So there is this idea that when a child hits 18, they are to go out on their own, have their own lives. But in Asian cultures, you are family forever, and you sometimes don't leave. You know, kids stay in the house and live in the house. And even if they have their own family, that family comes to live in the house. I mean, I grew up again, like with my father and my mother and my grandparents, like we all lived in one household. So I think that kind of idea is very foreign to white culture in the United States. But I think that other cultures can relate. I think that Latinx households can relate to this. A lot of immigrant traditional families, even European immigrants, that there are the kind of traditional household and African-American households as well, is I think that they can relate to the multi-generational and the closeness that people feel. And again, because Asian cultures are collectivistic, we are much more communal, and generations stick together. And that's part of the kind of culture that's been in Asia for, you know, ever since, you know, Asia was at the beginnings of Asia. It is something that's much more familiar to Asian culture. So we understood the kind of love that could be so violent, right? I think that there was, when my father actually, you know, married my mother, there was jealousy between my grandmother and that relationship. Mm-hmm. You know, one time they actually, my father and my mother, they lied to her and said that instead of, they told her they were going to work, but instead they took off work and had a date, which is like, so what in your U.S. culture, like, so what, right? But she got so mad that she made my father kneel like for like hours to punish him for lying to her. Mm-hmm.
It's like eating the dumpling. Yeah, it's the same thing.
So the violence, yes, the violence, the violent love. It's so strong, and it seems abusive, I think, too. Abusive or violent, you know, or unrealistic to other cultures. But this happens. This absolutely happens. Mm-hmm.
Thank you so much for joining me, Nancy. This is Meant to be Eaten on Heritage Radio Network. We'll be back at the same time next week.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
Hi, listeners. We want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food, including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway, and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola Aweli, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries. Like, why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode? Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, a French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.